This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 3rd of May, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The House votes to allow the prosecution of hate crimes motivated by a victim's sexual orientation. And we'll hear from France, where voters are preparing to cast their ballots in a heated deciding round for the country's next president. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Three investigations have been opened into the conduct of Los Angeles police at a peaceful rally for immigration reform held on May 1st at the city's MacArthur Park. Tanisizwe Shimarenga reports.
Organizers of the Los Angeles National Day of Action for Immigration Reform had a legal permit to occupy MacArthur Park until 9 p.m., but police descended on the park around 6 p.m., claiming that a small group of demonstrators had thrown rocks and plastic bottles at police officers on nearby Alvarado Street. Officers in full riot gear rushed the gathering, indiscriminately firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and foam-tipped plastic cartridges into the crowds, which included elderly people, children, and journalists. Several of those who were not able to leave the area fast enough were clubbed with riot batons. Angela Sanbrano is the executive director of CARESEN, the Central American Resource Center, one of the rally's organizers.
Not only were they not prepared to ensure the safety of the people, on the contrary, they were prepared to attack the people. We saw with our own eyes the motorcycles of the police attack the children, elderly people that were basically caring for their children.
The investigations that have already begun are a departmental review of tactics, an internal affairs investigation into the behavior of the officers and commanders on the scene, and an independent review by the investigative arm of the police commission, which sets policy for the police department. A request for the Los Angeles County District Attorney to launch an independent investigation into the officers' actions was also made by the California Assembly Speaker of the House, Fabian Nunez, who represents the district where MacArthur Park is located. In Los Angeles, this is Tandesizwe Shimarenga for FSRN.
All but one member of a Palestinian family are free after spending 6 months in a West Texas immigrant detention center. Renee Feltz has the details.
Radi Hazaza and three of his four children left the Rolling Plains Detention Center in Haskell, Texas on Wednesday. His 18-year-old son should be released later this week. The Hazazas sought political asylum when they came to the U.S. from Palestine in 2001. They appealed when a judge rejected their petition, and during that time, their travel documents expired. The family lived in Dallas until last November, when armed Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents raided their home in a midnight raid on the eve of the November elections. Some family members were released from a separate facility in February. The release of the rest of the family comes after the government conceded their deportation is unforeseeable, in part because they are stateless. A magistrate judge recommended their release earlier this year, but the courts could not act until 6 months had passed. The government waited until the last minute and released the family itself in order to avoid an unfavorable court ruling. The Hazaza's attorney, Joshua Bardavid, says he's dismayed the government waited 6 months to end their imprisonment. He argues if removal is unforeseeable now, it was unforeseeable before their arrest. The family says they were subjected to body cavity searches after complaining about lack of proper medical care while they were detained in a medium security prison contracted to detain immigrants alongside convicted criminals. From their apartment outside of Dallas, they will now apply for political asylum again, in a process that could take another year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
17 foreign workers were kidnapped in three separate incidents in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. This brings to 23 the number of foreigners that have been kidnapped in the region in the past 3 days. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The latest incidents took place between last night and this morning. Five of the 17 kidnapped workers were later released. Militants in the Niger Delta say they are stepping up their attacks on foreign oil workers and oil facilities ahead of May 29th, when the new president takes office. The militants, who are fighting for a share of oil resources in the Niger Delta, say they regard the new government as an extension of the current government. The elections that named Musa Yar'Adua as the president-elect were marred by irregularities. The American oil company Chevron Texaco was forced to shut down one of its facilities following an attack earlier this week. Nigeria's oil exports have dropped by 665,000 barrels a day on account of instability in the Niger Delta. for Free Speech Radio News. This is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
People gathered at sites around the country yesterday to protest President Bush's veto of a spending bill for the Iraq War that included a timetable for troop withdrawal. In New Haven, Connecticut, they rallied outside of the downtown residence of Senator Joe Lieberman, a staunch supporter of the war. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Joe Lieberman ran as an independent and won his third term in the Senate last year after losing the Democratic primary to an anti-war candidate. A large majority of the state's voters opposed the war, and Lieberman successfully campaigned on a platform of bringing the war to what he called an honorable end. Among the protesters was Amanda DeGioia, a member of the Amnesty International chapter of a local university. She volunteered to undergo a form of waterboarding, a torture technique that has been used during interrogations of prisoners held by the U.S. at Guantanamo, in which a person is made to feel he is drowning. A fellow student bound her hands, shoved a sponge in her mouth, and blindfolded her as she lay face up across a barrel. Then the student poured water over DeGioia's face until she stomped her feet on the ground to stop it.
The reason I volunteered to do this is because I felt that I needed to feel what it was like. I'm not even getting a taste of what they're getting, and I already know that it doesn't feel so nice. It feels awful.
The head of the local peace council noted that Lieberman had voted to legalize waterboarding as an interrogation technique permitted under the Military Commissions Act. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Congress voted on a bill today that would increase the ability of local law enforcement agencies to prosecute hate crimes motivated by a victim's sexual orientation or gender identity. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Current federal hate crime legislation allows for the prosecution of hate crimes motivated by race, religion, national origin, or color. The Local Law Enforcement Prevention Act of 2007 adds sexual orientation, gender identity, and disability to the list. Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon is co-author of the bill.
It's time to do this, and it's about time we do this. And with a new Congress, a new chapter in our Democratic history, we have an opportunity to come together as Republicans and Democrats, because sexual orientation doesn't register Republican or Democrat. And hate is visited upon people regardless of political affiliation. So it's about time we do this.
The Act provides additional federal resources for local law enforcement officers. Even though most states have hate crimes legislation, proponents of the bill say some local jurisdictions lack the funds and staffing to adequately prosecute these crimes. Representative James McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts.
While we have made progress toward equality in many facets of our society, hate crimes continue to spread in cities and towns across the country. The main reason why we have been unable to aggressively pursue and prosecute hate crimes is because law enforcement agencies in our states and towns lack the tools and resources.
More than 200 law enforcement, civic, and religious organizations support the bill, including the NAACP and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. But those who oppose the bill says it gives special protection to those in the lesbian and gay community. Representative Lamar Smith, Republican from Texas.
Every violent crime can be devastating not only to the victim, but also to the larger community whose public safety has been violated. That is why all violent crimes must be vigorously prosecuted. However, this bill, no matter how well-intended, undermines basic principles of our criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system has been built on the ideal of equal justice for all. Under this bill, justice will no longer be equal, but depend on the race, sex, sexual orientation, disability, or status of the victim.
Conservative groups strongly oppose the bill, saying it stops preachers from speaking openly with their parishioners. Mary Ann Salazar is an attorney with several conservative ministry groups.
What we're most afraid may happen is that it's going to erode the foundational principles of this country of two things: First Amendment right to free speech and freedom of religion. And the way it opens the door is it opens the door for the federal government and for judges to interpret this bill, where anyone who is saying anything against homosexuals from a pulpit, a preacher, let's say, in the instance of a church, can be persecuted if that person is subsequently hurt by anyone who heard that preacher say homosexuality is an abomination.
Representative John Conyers, Democrat from Michigan, says groups like these have nothing to worry about since a bill only addresses violent acts.
There is no First Amendment disabilities about this measure in any way. That would be the last thing that would be allowed to be in this bill. What we're saying now, a vote for this bill is not a vote in favor of any particular sexual belief or characteristic. It's a vote rather to provide basic rights for and protection for individuals so that they are protected from assaults based on their sexual orientation.
The bill was passed by a House vote of 237 to 180 and now will move to the Senate. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
There are reports this week of more than 80 civilian deaths in the western Herat province of Afghanistan. And just last night, Afghan Senator Abdul Sabur Farid was ambushed outside his home in Kabul. From Washington, D.C., Nan McCurdy has more.
Amid renewed pressure at home, Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai Wednesday said the intention may be very good to fight terrorism. Sometimes mistakes are made, but 5 years on, it is very difficult for us to continue to accept civilian casualties. It's not understandable anymore. The situation has become increasingly volatile in Afghanistan, and the population is directing its anger at Karzai and at the U.S.-led forces. In January, commanders of NATO forces said their biggest 2006 error was the killing of innocent people. Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill says the U.S. needs to focus more on political solutions in Afghanistan and Iraq.
We need to, you know, throw some elbows in NATO if necessary to make sure that the coalition is being respectful. If we can't win the hearts and minds of the people that live in Afghanistan, we're going to have the same problem in Afghanistan that we have in Iraq. This idea that we can do it just with military force, if we haven't figured it out now, after 4 years in Iraq, what's it going to take for this administration to figure it out?
Kathy Gannon, a journalist based in Pakistan, is the author of a book about Afghanistan called Eye is for Infidel, From Holy War to Holy Terror. Gannon says that people had hoped to rebuild soon after the collapse of the Taliban. But 6 years later, the situation is still chaotic.
Right now, it's a very complicated situation in Afghanistan because 90% or 80% of the insurgents are not necessarily ideologically married to the Taliban. They are now frustrated Afghans who are fed up with the level of corruption in their government. They are fed up with the corruption of the police. They are fed up with the lack of development and reconstruction. And really, 6 years almost after the collapse of the Taliban, there is a sense in much of Afghanistan that the promises that the international community made have not been kept, and people are hugely frustrated. What you have had is had a lot of civilian deaths that have angered the people of the villages. For example, they will go into an area and there will be heavy bombing, for example, in that area because that's an area where the Taliban have been spotted.
Gannon says Afghanistan today is as chaotic as it was before the Taliban took over in 1996. For FSRN, I'm Nan McCurdy.
With just 4 days to go before the deciding round in France's presidential election, 20 million people watched the two remaining candidates face off in a sometimes acrimonious television debate yesterday evening. Both socialist Ségolène Royal and right-winger Nicolas Sarkozy made a bid for the votes of candidates forced out in the first round, which put Sarkozy in the lead. FSRN's Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Both candidates declared themselves calm at the start of a 2.5-hour debate, but clashes of principle and ambition led to a certain tension.
Pas de mépris, Monsieur Sarkozy. Pas de mépris. Je n'ai pas perdu mes nerfs.
Normally poised and elegant, Madame Royale gets angry with the usually pugnacious Monsieur Sarkozy when he calls for handicapped children to have the legal right to be educated in ordinary schools. A law she introduced as Minister of Education made that possible, she says. But the right-wing government scrapped it. Support groups and teachers told today's newspapers that the law was scrapped, but not the jobs for social workers it created, and that Sarkozy's proposal is already technically possible. Both candidates agreed on many of the problems. That France's national debt, the fourth highest in Western Europe, is too high. That unemployment at over 2 million is also too high. And that economic growth at 2% is too low. Sarkozy's favorite answer is for people to work more.
Ce que je souhaite, c'est libérer la possibilité de travailler en France.
What I want to do is liberate the possibility of working in France. How? By encouraging people who want to earn more to work more. How will we do that? Today, everything possible is done to discourage overtime working. Any company that gives people overtime won't pay Social Security charges for it. Any employee who voluntarily works overtime won't pay tax on it.
Sarkozy claims that the 35-hour work week introduced by the socialists hasn't created any jobs, but has created chaos in the workplace, especially in the health service. But he says he won't abolish it, just loosen it up a little. Royal claims that the 35-hour week has created a million jobs and given people time to spend with their families. But she accepts that it has been badly implemented in some sectors. So she'll tell employers and unions, euphemistically known as the social partners here, to adjust it and discuss whether it would be extended to businesses where it doesn't apply yet.
Je le fais par une taxe sur les revenus boursiers, parce que je pense, en effet, qu'il faut de la justice. Les partenaires sociaux en discuteront, mais au moins le principe est là.
Et nous allons. Vous mettez combien sur le fond?
Je vous donne déjà les principes.
Royal, this time interrupted by Sarkozy, says she'll put more money into retirement pension funds. Like Sarkozy, she wants to raise the lowest pensions and keep paying an aging population. He asks how she'll pay for it. She says that she'll tax investment incomes to raise any extra cash needed after she's consulted the social partners. Sarkozy is angry that some pension funds in sectors like the railways give full rights after 37 years' contribution. In the name of equality, he says, he'll make them pay for the 41 years imposed elsewhere by a recent right-wing law.
Vous avez une approche très approximative sur un sujet quand même extrêmement.
More harsh words from Royal on the environment and nuclear power. Sarkozy claims that 50% of France's energy comes from nuclear power. She says it's 17. He says he'll continue and even expand it. She says she'll wait and see if it can be made safer. None of these subjects are technically the president's responsibility, although the new parliament to be elected in June is likely to be under his or her influence. So, finally, to the president's official remit, defence and foreign policy, should Turkey become part of the European Union?
It's time to tell the Turks whether we want them or not. For me, it's not a question of democracy. It's not at all a question of Muslims or Islam. It's that Turkey is in Asia Minor, it's not Europe. So we have to tell this great people, which is Turkey, that their vocation is to be at the heart of the Mediterranean Union, but not the European Union.
Royal is equivocal again. Turkey shouldn't join now, but if it becomes more secular and democratic, maybe. The socialist candidate impressed one viewer at least. Third-place candidate François Bayrou, whose votes she needs to win, declared that she performed well. But he didn't say he'd vote for her. Just that he won't be voting Sarkozy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
The Federal Communications Commission held a public hearing on the broadcast media ownership review this week, the fourth of six meetings around the country. All five members of the FCC attended, as well as representatives from media activist groups, members of local media organizations, and the public. FSRN's Sean Kenan was there to hear conflicting opinions on media concentration.
Our media have an obligation to reflect this country's diversity. They have an obligation to nourish this country's diversity, and it's a job that is not getting done.
FCC Commissioner Michael Copps opposes attempts to relax the rules against media conglomeration.
Even if media consolidation is not your number one issue, it ought to be your second most important, and that's because all those other issues you care about are increasingly funneled through the filter of big media. Now, if you're happy with how your number one issue is being presented and discussed as they come through that funnel, fine. You don't have to listen to a thing I'm saying. But if you think that that big issue might just benefit from a little more diversity of viewpoint and a little more competition, then you need to get involved.
In 2003, then FCC Chairman Michael Powell orchestrated rules changes that eliminated many rules governing media ownership that had kept companies from buying up large numbers of media outlets. The rules also prevented a single company from owning both newspaper and broadcast outlets in one market in most cases. A strong backlash from citizens culminated in a 2004 federal appeals court decision in Prometheus Radio Project v. FCC that overturned Powell's changes to media ownership limits. But many of those same changes are now back on the drawing board. Gerardo Reyes Chavez is an organizer with the Coalition of Mockley Workers and their low-power FM station, Radio Conciencia. He said that instead of letting big media get bigger, the FCC should permit more low-power FM stations.
While most workers have little access to the internet, newspapers, or television, Radio Conciencia gives Immokalee a voice and provides our community with the information it needs.
Tampa is one of a few cities in which a television station and major newspaper are owned by the same company, so it is seen as a model for what might happen if cross-ownership rules are relaxed. The Media General Corporation owns both the Tampa Tribune newspaper and the NBC television affiliate in Tampa. Former member of Congress and 2006 gubernatorial candidate Jim Davis is currently a lawyer in a firm representing Media General. He says cross-ownership of media is beneficial.
But in my experience, since the conversion, I believe there has been more hard news, less entertainment, not enough hard news for my taste, but still more, in both quantity and quality in the network that has experienced the conversion.
Other supporters of media consolidation or of cross-ownership said they were impressed with the charitable contributions of those media outlets or their efficiency or felt they served their communities well in times of crisis such as hurricanes. But Eric Kleinenberg, an associate professor of sociology at New York University, warned the audience about relaxing ownership restrictions.
With cross-ownership, citizens are exposed to fewer perspectives than when TV stations and newspapers are separately owned. So now we have to ask, who is going to benefit from cross-ownership? In my view, it's not journalists, it's not citizens, it's not cities, it's not communities, it's just a few corporations which will become even more profitable than they already are if you get rid of this rule.
Carol Jenkins is the president of the Women's Media Center. She said that women are underrepresented in media ownership and decision-making positions. For example, only 5% of the television stations in the U.S. are owned by women.
In mainstream media, we hold about 3% of the titles that could be described most effectively as clout positions. 3%. Even here today, symptomatic perhaps of our problem is that only 3 of the 21 panelists presenting today are women. We're glad to be here, though.
111 people spoke during nearly 4 hours of public testimony. An overwhelming majority opposed any further easing of rules against media conglomeration. Some suggestions they made to enhance diversity included mandating free airtime for political candidates, reinstating the fairness doctrine, and preventing renewal of a broadcaster's license until they have met public interest obligations. The FCC is currently accepting comments from the public regarding media ownership on their website at www.fcc.gov. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sean Canaan, reporting from Tampa, Florida.
Germany's federal prosecutor quashed a lawsuit filed in that country charging Donald Rumsfeld and other high-ranking U.S. officials with torture and war crimes. The case was filed on behalf of 12 Iraqi citizens detained at Abu Ghraib and one Saudi citizen still held at Guantanamo Bay, who say they were severely beaten, deprived of sleep and food, sexually abused, stripped, hooded, exposed to extreme temperatures, and frightened with dogs. Under Germany's universal jurisdiction law, people can be charged for war crimes and crimes against humanity, regardless of where such crimes are committed. Some say the federal prosecutor's ruling to drop the case against Rumsfeld and others is a result of political pressure from the United States. FSRN's Cinnamon Apart has more from Berlin.
Michael Ratner is an attorney, adjunct professor of law at Columbia University Law School, and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights based in New York. Ratner has been working closely with Berlin lawyer Wolfgang Kalleck to bring the lawsuit against Donald Rumsfeld and 13 other high-ranking American officials.
They include our current Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, who not only said we don't need to obey Geneva, but who actually approved various torture techniques. And they include a series of the lawyers, John Yoo in particular, who worked at the highest legal authority within the United States government, the Office of Legal Counsel, and wrote the memo saying the president can torture in the name of national security, what I call the Pinochet defense, because that's what Pinochet did in Chile.
Currently, these high-ranking officials enjoy almost total immunity in the U.S. But Germany's Code of Crimes Against International Law provides for universal jurisdiction for war crimes, crimes of genocide, and crimes against humanity. This means that this law allows Germany to pursue war crimes cases regardless of where they were committed. Wolfgang Kalik is the Berlin-based criminal defense and human rights lawyer who filed the case.
Germany has a quite open and modern so-called criminal code against international crimes. The second argument for Germany was that a lot of those military commanders who were involved in the Abu Ghraib torture incidents were stationed with their unit in Germany. So they were at least part-time present in Germany. And this is also a strong legal argument for a torture case in Germany.
But on Friday, the federal prosecutor decided not to pursue the case. Kalik and Ratner say this decision was politically motivated.
Well, underneath the so-called legal decision is always the politics of the case. And the sad part to me is that Germany, despite its excellent law, was just unwilling to politically say to the United States, we're going to investigate your high-level officials for torture. And so there was obviously a political decision made. Last time it was dismissed, it was direct political pressure. We were aware of that from the State Department, or at least from the Pentagon.
Ratner and Kalik also tried 2 years ago to charge Rumsfeld and others with war crimes. But after the United States leaned heavily on Germany, the then federal prosecutor dropped the case, arguing Germany could only take action if the United States was unable or unwilling to prosecute Rumsfeld. This time around, Germany's federal prosecutor argued that the crimes weren't committed in Germany, the defendants don't reside in Germany and won't come here anytime soon. This is despite the fact that the Universal Jurisdiction Law expressly states that it's a universal duty to fight torture and war crimes, wherever they occur.
It also has the implication that Germany is not willing to go after basically other Western powers on this issue. So It's not good at all in terms of the fact that Germany passed the law and then the prosecutor refuses to enforce it.
There have already been international precedents in Europe and South America. For example, international cooperation brought a case against Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, charging him with mass murder, torture, kidnapping and illegal detention. And universal jurisdiction has already been exercised in the Netherlands, the UK, Spain, Denmark and France to bring perpetrators to justice from countries such as Afghanistan, Argentina and Uganda. Ratner says that Spanish courts could be the next step.
Spain has a very good law on universal jurisdiction. Spain has also showed that it has courage in the Pinochet case, for example. Third, two of the Guantanamo detainees who are potentially could be involved in the case were actually tortured in Guantanamo and are Spanish citizens, so that Spain actually has a jurisdictional link that's in addition to universal jurisdiction, which would almost compel them to investigate the case. And the fourth reason is that Spain has already said in a related case that Guantanamo is an illegal black hole, essentially saying that Guantanamo is illegally detaining people.
Wherever Kalik and Ratner take the case next, it's clear that they won't give up the fight.
We all have to work for the absolute prohibition of torture all over the world, and we have to make clear that torture, wherever it's committed, from whomever it's committed, for whatever reason it's committed, has to be prosecuted.
Cinnamon Nippard, reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Today's newscast was produced by Tina Gysi and Monica Lopez. This week's Washington editor is Nan McCurdy. She's sitting in for Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.